assassinated in Mexico, a victim of one of the party members to which he belonged, Leon Trotsky made this statement: "Whoever among us longs for a quiet life has certainly chosen the wrong epoch. This is an age of crisis. This age in which you are growing up is an age of crisis. I don't know how aware you are of this fact. I'm not certain I'm as aware as I should be. But it doesn't take a great deal of perception to look around one and agree with that very simple statement. Now, by definition, a crisis is a crucial time and turning point, the outcome of which determines the consequences that follow, which might be life or death, good or evil, freedom or slavery, victory or defeat, growth or sterility." And when you think of that particular comparison which I've just enumerated, I think we agree that we are, in fact, involved in and meshed in, we have been thrust into an age of crisis. Perhaps not by choice, but nonetheless, we're here. And what is going on today, I believe with all my heart, is going to determine the consequences that you will reap after 30 years of age. And whether those consequences may be, as I've already mentioned, life or death, good or evil, freedom or slavery, victory or defeat, growth or sterility, depends not to a large extent, but depends completely on what is done during this moment of opportunity in a critical period. I am not by nature an alarmist. I do believe and I trust that I am a man of conviction. And what I have just stated is a very real conviction. You who are sitting in this room tonight will either forge or allow to slip through your fingers the molding of what will happen 10 years from tonight. According to statistics, Marxism, Marxism covers over one-third of the world's population and controls it tonight. You are aware of the fact, as I am, that Marxism is basically atheistic, and not only atheistic, but bent. One of their stated purposes is the eradication of the so-called Christian church. And yet, former British Foreign Secretary Lord Hume made this statement: "There is nothing inevitable in the progress of communism." You see, there are some people who sort of think, and this is among those who are claiming to be followers of Christ, who sort of feel, well, you can't stop it, it's just going to sweep over the world, and maybe the Lord will come before it possesses us all, or maybe this will be part of the tribulation, or so on and so on. And they almost have a defeatist attitude about this one specific thing. Now notice the comment: "There is nothing inevitable in the progress of communism. It will advance or be defeated in proportion to the virility of the philosophy or way of life which opposes it." It will advance or be defeated in proportion to the virility or reality of the philosophy or way of life that opposes it. Therefore, there is a tremendous need tonight for men and women who not only have an objective, but men and women who have a strategy for accomplishing that objective. There is need for for a strategy. Now, strategy is always determined by objectives. And obviously, if one does not know what his objective is, he cannot correctly, effectively determine a strategy to accomplish that objective. Now, you and I, as followers of Jesus Christ, have had our objectives set for us. And I'm going to mention them briefly, and we'll come back to them again later. But we have the first one in Mark, the 16th chapter. When Jesus made the proclamation that we are to go and preach the gospel to every creature. Now that is part of God's objective for this day and age. But there is a second part, which is just as real and just as important, and which we dare not lose in the midst of any circumstances. And that's found in Matthew, the 28th chapter, verses 18 and 19 particularly. And Jesus, again, making a proclamation to his disciples, said that we are to go and make disciples. Not simply the preaching of the gospel to every creature, as important as that is, but to make disciples. Now, I did some reading, rereading and reviewing of some books that I have, and I gathered two or three statements that I want to share with you tonight, which demonstrate the thinking of some of the people that are involved in seeking to accomplish these objectives. Now, remember I said, a strategy must be based on objectives. Once you have an objective, then you can begin working on a strategy. And these men, recognizing the objectives, have sought to devise strategies and have come up with some statements that I feel are extremely important to you and to me tonight. You see, there are too many people, and this is by their admission, I'm quoting now, too many waiting for circumstances to determine their course. Some of you are in that category. You wait for circumstances to determine your course. You can never devise a strategy on that basis. I've watched missions that have operated on this basis, and they never accomplish anything. They're driven by the wind of change. Wherever they are, whatever they're doing. And they see something good come along that they think they'll try, and they try it, and it doesn't work, so they look for something else good that they think comes along, and they try that. And there's no direction. They haven't determined and agreed upon a basic strategy. How are we going to accomplish the objective? Now, here are the statements. One of the men said, "How can we be sure that our missionaries and those that we're sending out understand our strategy?" You see, the problem is they send out people and they all have divergent ideas, and when they get on the field, everyone sort of goes his own way, doing that which seems right in his own eyes. And one of the basic elements of strategy is a unified team or command of operation. And you see, if you'll permit me, parenthetically, the navigators feel that we have found at least a good part of the answer to this problem. And it's simply in the personal, individual impartation of the strategy prior to any kind of an assignment. Someone was asking me tonight at dinner, how long does it usually take to be able to go out as a staff member for the navigators? And we talked about this. And it is a long time. There's no question about it. And it can be pretty discouraging to some people. But you see, we have found that it is so vital and so important that when people go out to represent the work that we feel God has given us to do, that we have no question in our mind, but that we are one in objective and strategy. And by the grace of God, I believe that we'll begin to see more and more results all over the world because of this. Another statement made by these gentlemen is the matter, the concern that they have of the individual interpretation of the strategy. And this is happening constantly. And there will be two missionaries on a given field, each one of them feeling that they're doing things in the right way, completely different as far as strategy is concerned. Again, the navigators feel that we found a partial answer to this. And some of you have heard something about this and will hear more and more about it. And that is the concept of working as a team in a close-knit unit where day after day after day we reevaluate and we check and consider and surmise together and develop strategy and watch one another and make certain that we catch it. It isn't a happenstance. It isn't something that we take for granted. It's something that we experience in the forge of day-to-day routine and experience. And an individual who has the opportunity of that kind of training will know where he's going and how to reach that objective. Harold Cook, in his book, Strategy of Missions, makes this comment, and this is what we're heading for. I hope you understand that all I'm saying now is by way of introduction. Don't be dismayed. We'll get to something eventually. Even, he said this, even more clearly restrictive in the planning of mission strategy is the lack of personnel suitable for carrying out the plans. And this is happening. This is the major problem that the average mission faces today. We're talking here about world-conquering disciples. Why hasn't the world been conquered for Christ? Is it the message? Has it lost its power? Is it impotent? No, I think that Mr. Cook has hit on a very vital situation. More clearly restrictive in the planning of mission strategy is the lack of personnel suitable for carrying out the plans. We call it spiritually qualified men and women. Spiritually qualified disciples. This is what we talk about, and this is what we aim at, and we'll continue to aim at. And then just one last comment. And this one is from a book entitled Conflict and Conquest in Holiness, which is actually a story or a study of the life of Joshua. It's by a man by the name of Dr. J.C. Massey, M-A-S-S-E-E. And he says this, "The success of every man's work depends ultimately on his successor." Now, some of you caught the importance of that statement. Some of you didn't. It's obvious. But this is exactly what we pin our entire operation on. We may not say it quite this way. Dr. Massey had his way of stating it. We have a different way. The success of every man's work depends ultimately on his successor. What kind of a successor? How well was he trained? How adequately does he carry on what you sought to start? You see, we're not just interested in disciples. We're interested in disciples who are disciple makers. And there's a big difference. Disciples who are disciple makers. Merrill C. Tenney made this observation about discipleship. This man is not a navigator. It's from a book entitled Facing Facts in Modern Missions. He's a professor of missions at Wheaton College. Discipleship may be a slow process because it involves growth. Conversion is instant, hinging on the decision to become a disciple, but maturity of experience requires training and time. Large numbers of converts may not always indicate success, nor the lack of them failure. A few Christians who are certain of their hope, settled in conviction, and ethically sound are worth 100 who are only nominal in their allegiance to Christ. Discipleship involves evangelization, because as each imparts his knowledge to another and undertakes the responsibility of teaching him, the message is spread from person to person. One sometimes wonders, says Dr. Tenney, whether the elaborate organization and costly equipment employed in much of our missionary evangelism is necessary. Will missionaries become so engrossed in operating their machinery that they will have no time for the personal contacts that make disciples? One consecrated follower of Christ, soundly converted and thoroughly trained in Christian thinking and ethic, is worth a dozen committees or a loudspeaker system. So says Dr. Tenney. I couldn't have said it much clearer myself. I read a story the other day, and it fits beautifully right here. From the Middle Ages, a man by the name of Abu Taber in the Middle East, a ruler of a small kingdom. The whole area was being invaded by another king. And with the hordes of men that he had, he was sweeping the country. And he arrived at the border of Abu Taber, and having heard of his bravery, he sent an ambassador of peace. And he said, Abu Taber, we don't want to destroy you or your men. Let's make a treaty. Let's make a peace. Abu Taber did not answer him. Rather, he called one of his men. The man hurried over. Abu Taber looked him in the eye, and he said, take your dagger and plunge it into your heart. The man reached into his side, drew from the sheath the dagger, plunged it into his heart, and fell dead at the feet of Abu Taber. He called another man, and he said, I want you to walk over to the precipice and throw yourself into the gorge of the river Euphrates. The man walked over without hesitation, plunged into the river Euphrates, and died. Abu Taber turned to this emissary, and he said, go and tell your king that I have 500 other men just like these. And by the time this day is over, your master will be tied with my dogs. The other king sought to invade. And with 500 men who were committed and dedicated and had no other allegiance but that to Abu Taber, they defeated the horde. And true to his prediction, the invading king was tied with his dogs by the end of that day. Now, this is a historical story. We could go back further in history and see what God did with 300 men, with pitchers and little lamps and a trumpet to blow. How many of you fellas would have been willing to run down into that camp, knowing that you were going right in the middle of the enemy's territory with no defense, nothing. A pitcher to break, a lamp to show, and a horn to blow. And that's it. Why am I saying this? Because this is the kind of men in a spiritual sense that are going to do that are going to conquer for Christ's sake. You see, this whole area of what it means to be a disciple has become so blurred There's need for a strategy. Now, our strategy, as I have already mentioned, is very simple. Disciple makers. Disciple makers. Not just disciples, but disciples who are disciple makers. You see, in that passage in Matthew 28, 18, there's one word that we need to keep very closely in our thinking. He says, teaching them to observe all, that word all, that I have commanded you. That includes making disciples. Jesus commanded that. And if we are not teaching people to make disciples, we're only doing half the job. Just half. So our strategy is very simple. Our objectives have been set, and our strategy is very simple. We are out to look for men and women who are willing to become disciples, first of all. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But secondly, who are willing to be taught to be disciple makers. Because this is the key. The multiplication of disciples will not come by simply producing disciples. It will come by producing disciples who are disciple makers. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but the navigators, whether by stated purpose or not, the navigators are out to upset the status quo. And we're doing it. We're not doing it with the wrong spirit. But wherever this is happening, things are being upset. And the complacency in which the church has found itself for so long is being rocked. And the status quo is being upset. Let me quote a statement made by a churchman, a historical churchman. Protestantism has become a comfortable middle-class movement. It has lost contact with the oppressed, the frustrated, the rebellious. This is true. We've become a very comfortable community. We preach separation, but what we really mean is isolation. I'm talking now in general terms. The navigators desire to change that situation. Not negatively, but with the positive presentation of this matter of strategy of making disciple makers. People who are not satisfied with a complacent, easy, rock-along type of Christianity. People who are like the soldiers of Abu Thabit, who aren't, it isn't necessary to ask them twice, but they respond to the command immediately. These are going to be the people that are going to be world-conquering disciples. Perhaps this is one reason why the world hasn't been conquered to this moment. I believe with all my heart, as I talk with people in various parts of the world and here in the United States, I believe that people are tired of playing games in the middle of a battle. And do you know something? When you talk to someone about their personal relationship with Jesus Christ, if you can get them to think in different terms than that which they normally associate with that, which may be something completely foreign to what the Bible says, it may be called a religion, and they may have a lot of activity going on, but there's no reality, and it hasn't answered their problems. It hasn't met their needs. And they've given it all up, because as far as they're concerned, those people are just playing games. They meet three times a week, and they have their meetings, and they sing their songs, and they listen to their little platitudes, but there's nothing happening that's changing lives. And it's not meeting their need. And they realize that they're in a battle. They know that they're in a battle. They know it in their heart. They have deep needs. But they don't want to play games. It's like playing cops and robbers in Vietnam. A war raging all around. And people not producing the goods. Not giving the truth of the word continually. Now, disciples are not produced in a comfortable sanctuary of study and fellowship, but in the bloody and often disheartening conflict against the enemy. I wonder if you believe that. I wonder if you care. We say, I want to be a disciple. There's a hymn. How many of you have heard the hymn, Am I a Soldier of the Cross? Well, there are a couple of verses that say something like this. Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas? No. No, I must fight if I would reign. Increase my courage, Lord. I'll bear the toil, endure the pain, supported by thy word. Disciples are produced in the middle of a bloody and often disheartening conflict against the enemy. Jesus never made it easy. His demands were constant. It's interesting as you read the Gospels and find how the multitudes gathered around Jesus. Now today, we are multitude conscious. We are numbers conscious. You have a Bible study, and one of the first things anybody asks is, how many were there? Have a conference? How many came? And somehow, we have allowed ourselves to develop a mentality that success is dependent on multitude. Jesus worked just the opposite. And he worked at it deliberately. The multitude would gather around and follow him, and Jesus never flattered them. He wasn't that anxious to hold on to them. He never flattered. He never induced by promises, you know. Now, if you'll vote for me, I'll do this and this and this. There was never any inducement of that kind. He told them what he promised. He told them what he came to give them. But he always qualified that with what he demanded. Listen, I said demanded, not just suggested. You see, we have treated this entire matter of discipleship as a suggestion. It was never a suggestion. It's a demand of Jesus Christ. He said, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. In Luke 9:23. It's a demand. It's an open statement. And Jesus began doing this from the very beginning. And as these multitudes would gather around him, he purposefully thinned them out. Because he wanted to finish up with what he knew were committed, dedicated, wholehearted disciples that he could count on. That's what he wanted. And there weren't very many of them, as you know. Some of you have read the history of Italy, and you remember the name of Garibaldi. And you remember how when Garibaldi came in to try to liberate his country from the invading hordes, he started with nothing. And as he walked the streets of these towns, he would approach groups of young men, and he would ask them to follow him. And often they would say, what do you offer us? Isn't that interesting? But we do the same thing, don't we? We may not state it quite like that, But so often we're more involved in sort of what's in this for me. All right, so Sanchez, you're up there preaching about discipleship. What am I going to get out of it? You're up there talking about conquering the world. What's in it for me? I'm that way. I suppose some of you might be. And he would approach these young men and they would ask him, what's in it for us? What do you offer us? And here's what Garibaldi would reply. I offer you no pay, provision, or quarters. Almost sounds like Glen Eyrie, doesn't it? I offer you hunger, thirst, forced marches, battle, and death. And then he would add this. Let him who loves his country in his heart, not with his lips only, follow me. Jesus says exactly the same thing, doesn't he? He who has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loves me. Not just the statement of the lips, but the attitude and action of the life. The reality of our claims is exhibited in our expression, the total expression of life. And Garibaldi raised up over 1,000 young men. They wore red shirts. And some of you wear berets and some wear other things. Well, these guys wore red shirts to identify themselves. They belonged. They were part of this group that had accepted the challenge. And they weren't expecting any pay or provision or quarters. And they knew what faced them. But they went. And they liberated their country. And for the first time in the history of that country, they were free to choose whom they would have rule them. Jesus knew that the multitudes would never fulfill his commission. He knows it today. Jesus knows that it's not the multitude that's going to be able to go out and preach the gospel to every creature and to make disciples. He knew it then, and he knows it now. And then as now, he says to us right here tonight, it's going to be difficult instead of easy. It's going to be dangerous instead of delightful. It's going to be costly instead of thrilling. It's going to be exacting instead of exciting. And there are going to be foes instead of friends. Now Jesus says this very clearly, time and time again. Now gang, I'm trying to be as honest as I know how. I am so convinced that this is what must happen. Anything less than this isn't just, it's just not going to get the job done. And so the summary of our strategy, if you please, is found in Acts 14:21. A very simple little verse. When they had preached the gospel to that city, and had made many disciples. So there it is. Now, in closing, I'd like to ask two questions. Why? Why should we be so concerned about all of this? Why should you be concerned? I'd like to suggest a couple of reasons why, whether you are concerned tonight or not. These are reasons why you should be. If you are, they'll strengthen your concern. And if you're not, perhaps they'll make you reconsider and develop a concern. First, the Master has asked us to. Abu Taber told his man, plunge the dagger into your heart. That was all the man needed. Jesus has said, go and preach and make disciples. You see, we shouldn't need anything else. We shouldn't need to have people stand up and encourage us and keep reminding us and keep telling us that that's what we should do and challenging us and alerting us and waking us up and stimulating us. Jesus said it. And a true disciple will give himself to accomplishing this. It will simply be his life. Not a part of his life, it will be his life. Preaching the gospel and making disciples who are disciple makers. He that hath my commandments and keepeth them, he it is that loveth me. So he's asked us to, and an expression of our love is obedience to what he has asked. Secondly, we should be concerned because we ought to be regarding the vindication of his name in a world that has no concept of what his name means. His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. You shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sin. David went before the giant Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. And he said, I'm coming to you for one reason. I'm not coming to you to save these wretched soldiers that are afraid of you. I'm not coming even to rescue my brothers who are back there. They're as cowardly as the rest. I'm coming for one reason. I'm coming to prove to you that there is a God in Israel who hears and answers prayer. And he took that rock in his sling and he wound up and he connected. There was just one objective, to vindicate the name of God among the heathen. I'm concerned about this. Everybody I get a chance to talk to, this morning, just before I pulled out to come down here, I was out in the front taking care of a couple of things, and the milkman went by. And he stopped to come over and try and sell us some milk. And so I let him, you know, give me a sales talk. And then I told him that we bought our milk at Safeway. And that was fine. You know, we appreciated his coming by. And he said, well, now tell me, what are you doing here? I said, I'm glad you asked that. And I told him exactly why we've gone to Greeley. To try and help men and women, particularly on that college campus, recognize the reality of God in Jesus Christ in their lives. And I had a chance to talk to him about what this means. And I know one thing. I know that that milkman will never use the name of God or Jesus Christ again, ignorantly. Are you concerned about this? You see, well, let's go on to the next point. Third, the fulfillment of the purpose of the cross. This is why you should be concerned about conquering the world for Christ. Jesus Christ came to accomplish a certain thing. And it's enumerated very clearly and very specifically in Isaiah, the 61st chapter, and also in Luke, the 4th chapter. But in Isaiah 61, it's perhaps a little more extensive and a little more clear, and this is what it says. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me. Now this is prophetic utterance. And Jesus himself took this very scripture and quoted it regarding himself in Luke, the 4th chapter. But listen to it here. The Lord has anointed me to bring good tidings to the afflicted. If we have ever lived in an age of affliction, it's today. Did any of you see the program last week? I didn't get to see it. I was at a meeting, but I got back in time for the last few minutes of it. But the program, the three-hour presentation on syndicated crime in the United States, did any of you see it at all? I'm glad you did. Just one out of this whole crowd. Now, I don't advocate a lot of time in front of the mad monster eye. But occasionally, a program like this can be exceedingly interesting and alerting. I think this one was. At any rate, at the very end of the program, they asked the commentator the question, what can be done? Because of, obviously, the situation in the United States with syndicated crime is something that is almost unbelievable. And he said, virtually nothing can be done. He said, syndicated crime exists because people want it. They want the gambling. They want the prostitution. They want the loans, even though they're loans that charge them as much as 20% every month. But they want it because they can get illegal money. People want the services that syndicated crime offer them. And then he made this last statement. He said the only thing that could possibly change the situation would be to change the hearts of the American public. That's what Jesus came to do. And when I say that we are to be concerned in order that the purposes of the cross might be fulfilled, this is one of them. It says that he has been sent to bring good tidings to the afflicted, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives, and the opening of prison to those who are bound. That's why Jesus came. And that's why you should be concerned regarding whether or not you are willing to be a disciple through whom he can accomplish his objectives and conquer the world. And the fourth thing why you should be concerned is to see him given his rightful place as Lord in the lives of men and women. Now, obviously, it has to begin with me and with you. And if he doesn't have his rightful place as Lord in your life and mine, we can't very well be concerned that he have it in someone else's life. But by the grace of God, once we are committed in that area to the best of our ability, and don't forget, commitment is not something that's done once and taken care of forever. It's something that you do daily and sometimes two and three times a day. Every time that self, every time that ego, every time your own personal desires are coming to the front and you know that there's something else that God would have you do. It's a new area for commitment or recommitment, as the case might be. And it may happen once or twice or four times a day or more. Commitment is something that goes on constantly. But once this has been taken care of, then we are to be concerned that he be given that same place in the lives of men and women. Don't you want to be involved in gathering together that throng that's going to be before his throne someday? Up there, and we're going to fall at his feet as they do in Revelation, the 4th chapter and the 11th verse, and we're all going to sing together, Thou art worthy to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. Listen, I want to have a part in getting people there to do that. And I want to see them give him his rightful place as Lord now. So that's why we should be concerned. Now, how is this going to be done? You're covering this through the whole conference, and I'm just going to touch lightly on it rather than go into any lengthy explanation. I've already mentioned how, and that's simply by disciples who are disciple makers. But I'd like to give three broad qualifications. One, these disciples who are disciple makers must be people with a great hunger for God. Do you have a deep hunger for God tonight? If you don't get all shaken about it. Just admit it and ask God to give you a hunger for Himself. Because He promised He would. See, it's not something you can stir up. It's not something you can kind of rev up emotionally. It's something we have to ask Him for. Moses found this out. And in his exchange with God in the 33rd chapter of Exodus, verse 13, he says, "Now therefore I pray thee, if I have found favor in thy sight, show me now thy way, that I may know thee, that I may find favor in thy sight." That was Exodus 33:13. You see, Moses realized, even though he did have a desire, he needed God's guidance to know Him better, that he would have a greater desire for Him. David said this in Psalm 27:4. "One thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in His temple." Paul says it, Philippians 3:10, a verse that you know very well. After all those years of serving the Lord, there was still one supreme desire in Paul's heart, and he said, "That I may," what? "Know Him, the power of His resurrection and the fellowship of His suffering, being made conformable unto His death." That I may know Him. A hunger for God. So this is the beginning point. Secondly, people who are fearlessly, openly identified with Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus, when He said in Luke 9:23, "Let him deny himself, that is, give up all rights to himself," that's what it means, "take up his cross daily and follow me." That second phrase, "take up his cross daily," simply means an open, fearless identification with Him. It doesn't mean bearing some burden of illness or some burden that comes along because of our family or something like this. Those are things that we have no control over. Those are things that God allows to come into our lives. Those are not crosses. Scripture never talks about them that way. They're tests. They're trials. But they're not crosses. The cross that Jesus offers is something you can voluntarily take up or not take up. And this is identification with Him. A fearless, open, daily identification with Jesus Christ. And then finally, the third thing, not only must these people, these disciple makers, be, first of all, people with a hunger for God, secondly, openly and fearlessly identified with Him, but third, they must be spiritually qualified. And here you're dealing with many of these things through the week, and we won't go into them. But the basic things that have to do with spiritual growth and development must be strong and clear and clean in the life of this individual. I was flying with a flying instructor just the day before yesterday, or yesterday I guess it was, I don't remember. And he was demonstrating for me some of the basic maneuvers that he teaches the people that he takes up to instruct. And when we came down, he happens to be a new Christian, and we've just been fellowshipping together. And when he came down, as we were coming down, he said, "Now you see, George, those things I showed you, those four basic maneuvers, those are what we call the basics." And I sort of smiled inside, you know, I thought, boy, this guy's leading with his chin. And when he said, "Now, these things must be learned well." He said, "We can have a man who's an outstanding navigator, but if he doesn't have these basic things, he's a poor pilot." Or he said, "We can have a guy who can chart courses and do all kinds of things, but if he doesn't know how to operate these four basic things, he's a poor pilot." Four. Oh, nice. You know? I said, "You know, that's interesting." And then I told him about some basic things. Happens to be four, too, doesn't it? The Word and prayer and obedience and witnessing. A disciple who is a disciple maker must be strong in the basics. Now, gang, we are so convinced that this is the strategy that God has given us, that we are putting all of our eggs in one basket. Completely. And God is beginning to demonstrate the reality of this all around the world. I haven't taken time tonight to tell you some of the illustrations that we could of how this is happening. But let me assure you that it does work. And I'm convinced that if we are the kind of people that God can use, and we utilize the strategy that He has given us, His objective can be accomplished. And gang, this is not a dramatic statement. This is a basic commitment and conviction of my heart. The job can be done. With people like you, and others like you from other countries of the world who will be raised up, who will be willing to be disciples, who are disciple makers. And then by the grace of God, we'll have world conquering disciples. Let's pray.